Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab & Company, Incorporated, whose local branch is now located at 1155 College Mall Road. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, and team offer personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And need more coffee roasters? A woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. Offering signature drinks, teas, and little eats. Located on Pete Ellis Drive. NeedMoreRoasters.com. From WFIU, I'm Kate Young, and this is Earth Eats.
I think it's interesting to take a food that is so commonplace in our diet, so ubiquitous, so expected, and to cast a critical eye on it and just kind of interrogate, you know, why do we think that this is a, quote, normal thing to do?
Andrea Wiley studies the human consumption of cow's milk. Many of us have been instructed to drink our milk from an early age. But is dairy really a necessary part of a healthy diet for children? What about adults? Maddie Chera and Lee Bush examine these questions and more with food scholar Andrea Wiley. Harvest Public Media looks at the rise of government food assistance in rural areas. Chef D teaches us how to make beef jerky. And Susan Mintard has a warming soup for a cool evening. All that coming up after the news. Hi, Alex.
Hi, Kate.
What's happening?
Midterm elections are around the corner. Folks who are listening to this as a podcast might know the results, but those of us who have yet to experience November 6th still don't know what's going to happen. The elections are going to affect the outcome of the Farm Bill. I've got some updates as to how. And it's November, which means it's time to start talking tofurkey. Congress continues to grapple with a stalled and overdue Farm Bill as the midterm elections draw closer. One of the top sticking points is a proposal for heavier restrictions on food stamp recipients. The Senate has already passed a version without those changes, saying the extra requirements are not politically workable. But the House version includes $20 billion in cuts to SNAP benefits over the next decade. The Congressional Budget Office estimates the cuts would mean 1.2 million low-income Americans would lose their benefits. The House bill would also put stricter work requirements on about 7 million adults. To qualify for benefits, they would have to work at least 25 hours per week or spend the equivalent in job training. Also on the chopping block are programs that pay farmers to improve soil and water health. The Conservation Stewardship Program started in 2002 and covered about 72 million acres by the end of 2017. Both versions of the Farm Bill include significant cuts. Though the House version would roll back much more of the program's funding and rolls the remainder over into other programs. Speaking to the Future Farmers of America in Indianapolis recently, President Trump said Congress would wait until next year to vote on the Farm Bill in hopes that Republicans would have more muscle after the election. But midterm results could also shuffle the makeup of the House Agriculture Committee, which has four seats opening up in 2019. Leaders from the two chambers have to hammer out a version before passing it to the president. The Farm Bill that passed in 2014 expired on September 30th, after the House and the Senate failed to find a workable compromise to renew it. Negotiators have indicated the Farm Bill would be a top priority in the next session after the election on November 6th. Also this week, there's a coalition that's challenging Missouri's new meat labeling law. It filed a motion this week to keep it from being enforced. The law prohibits companies from in any way representing something as meat that's not made from animal flesh. Backers say the law protects consumers, but none were immediately available for comment. But Tony Rothert, with the ACLU of Missouri, says it's unconstitutional.
This is the government in the state of Missouri telling people that they cannot use certain words. It's classic censorship.
Rothert says Missouri has presented no evidence that consumers are confused by plant-based meat substitute products, like tofurkey. So the government has no reason to be involved. The current lawsuit could play a role when it comes to meat grown in laboratories, which could be commercially available in the next few years. Thanks to Chad Bouchard and Harvest Public Media for those stories.
Find more food news at eartheats.org and on Twitter, @EarthEats. Alex Chambers, thanks. Since the late 1970s, congressional leaders have placed food aid programs in the Farm Bill to attract votes from urban legislators. The thinking was that congressional representatives from the cities would support a bill aimed at rural areas if they could get help where food stamp use was highest, in the inner cities. Harvest Public Media's Peggy Lowe reports that may now change as the need has moved to a new area.
It's a busy football Saturday at this grocery store in rural southwest Iowa near the Iowa-Nebraska state line. Store manager Nick Johnson is working the checkout as folks buy hamburger, soda pop, and chips.
$8.20.
Johnson says times have been tough around here. Lots of people lost their manufacturing jobs during the recession, though he says that it looks like some of those are coming back. And farm income is down across the country thanks to low crop prices. In this tiny corner of Iowa, nearly 40,000 people get assistance from the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, what used to be known as food stamps. Most are white, and 40% live under the poverty level.
There's a lot of farmers in this community. There's a lot of people that have their own businesses, so they try to do the best they can.
Numbers from the U.S. Department of Agriculture show that since 2012, SNAP participation is highest among households in rural areas and small towns under 2,500 people.
But it wasn't shocking or surprising when you think about the degree to which SNAP is related to people being poor.
Ellen Volinger is with the Food Research and Action Center, a nonprofit fighting poverty-related hunger. The center analyzed the USDA data and found that nationally, 16% of households in rural areas use SNAP versus 13% in urban areas. Volinger says the elderly population is larger in rural areas, which is driving the increase.
And the data, if anything, probably suggests that there could be an even greater reach for SNAP in rural areas if it was doing a stronger job of reaching more of the elderly who are, in fact, eligible but not participating.
Volinger says other people in rural areas who need food aid are low-wage workers who just don't make enough or don't get enough hours at work. Many are families with children. Nick Johnson, the grocer, says that over the years, he's seeing more of his customers buying healthy food.
So you see more people with bread, milk, eggs, pasta.
About a fifth of his store's annual revenue comes from SNAP, Johnson says. And that's about average, according to David Proctor of the Rural Grocery Initiative at Kansas State University. He surveyed Kansas rural grocers on income from SNAP and another federal program that specifically helps mothers and children.
We get different percentages, I mean, from different owners, but, you know, anywhere from, say, 10% up to about 25% of their sales, they tell us, come from those federal food assistance programs.
Proctor says the federal food aid spent in grocery stores helps fuel small town economies. He says those rural grocers need electricians, carpenters, and other service providers. USDA data shows that every dollar spent in SNAP generates up to $1.80 in economic activity in that area.
For every dollar that is spent in a local grocery store in SNAP, those dollars then translate into local economic development.
The other big winner with SNAP dollars? Chain stores that cater to rural areas like Dollar General. And the USDA says that last year, big box stores like Walmart took in more than half of the billions set aside for SNAP. Peggy Lowe, Harvest Public Media.
More news from this reporter collective at harvestpublicmedia.org. Next, we join Chef Daniel Orr to learn about a food preservation method with autumn written all over it.
Today, we're going to make some beef jerky.
Now, this isn't going to be your gas station beef jerky. This is Chef D's beef jerky. You want to look for very lean meat. Usually I say you want to look for something that's marbled well and it's got all these fatty structures throughout the meat. But when you're drying meat, you don't want a lot of fat because that can go rancid, doesn't keep as long. So you want to look for very lean meat. So no marbling or very little marbling. You can see that here in this piece of meat. Now what I've done is I've gone through and I've cut off any fat and any white membranes that would be tough. I'm going to cut against the grain as thin as I can, but still getting nice slices. I like to do about a pound at a time, and this doesn't have to be beef. You know, we're talking about lean meats, so venison is probably my favorite kind of jerky.
Chef D says the flavoring is really up to you and your individual tastes. He's got some suggestions, though, for a tasty beef jerky marinade. He starts with a quarter cup of soy sauce, or you can use tamari to make it gluten-free, and a tablespoon of honey.
Okay, we're going to add some garlic powder. Now, generally, I like to use fresh garlic, but you're making something that's going to be dried. So dried is fine. And I added about a tablespoon. Add about a tablespoon of chili powder. Now, since we're not cooking this over an open fire, we are going to add some liquid smoke. And not much, just about a teaspoon. Now, I like to add things. This is what makes it kind of Chef D style. We're going to add some turmeric. We're going to add, now take it kind of instead of just a teriyaki, which you see at the, you know, Rural King, we're going to put some sesame seeds in it. About a quarter of a cup, about a quarter cup of seaweed powder. So this is the nori, which is what you get wrapped around sushi, except for it's ground. And a little bit of my own hot sauce.
Once you've added all the seasonings, you'll want to toss the mixture with the meat and store it in the fridge for an hour or so to marinate. Next, we head over to the dehydrator.
And we're going
to
lay this out in single layers. And if you don't have a dehydrator, you can do it in a low oven. But the flatter you can get it, the quicker, more evenly it's going to dry. Okay, we're going to add another layer to the dehydrator. Divide it out so it's very thin. And it only takes about 24 hours or less to make jerky. And this smells so good when it's drying. You know, it's, and I wake up in the middle of the night and I'm like, what did I leave on the stove? Yeah, it's a circular machine, probably about 14 inches wide, and you want to line everything up so everything's closed and then turn it on.
Now, is that the kind that has the fan, or is that just a heat element?
It has a fan, so it's heating and circulating. And then about 24 hours later, this is what you get.
Wow, that's a lot of fun.
What I don't like about a lot of the commercial ones is that they're sweet and they're soggy and they're salty. And I think that this is great for people that are on different, you know, healthy eating programs and they want to have protein without a lot of fat and they want something kind of snacky. And then you can just put it in this pretty jar and put a lid on it. And it'd make a great gift, too.
So there you have it, Chef D's homemade beef jerky. Find that recipe and so many others at eartheats.org. My favorite is beef jerky. I'm a bag of
bomb. I'm a bag of bomb.
Production support comes from The Clean Bedroom, offering organic mattresses, adjustable beds, and pillows, helping mindful customers create a sustainable and organic clean bedroom step by step. New York City, Boston, and now Indianapolis. More at thecleanbedroom.com. And Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, whose local branch is now located at 1155 College Mall Road. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, and team offer personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Andrea Wiley is a professor of anthropology and human biology at Indiana University. We're talking with her today about milk. This interview originally aired in early 2017, and Earth Eats founder and former host Annie Corrigan starts things off.
To set up the conversation, I wanted to see what recommendations the government has for our dairy consumption. So I checked out choosemyplate.gov, and here's what it says. So for 2 to 3-year-olds, it's 2 cups from the dairy group every day. Add another 1/2 cup for 4 to 8-year-olds. And then once you hit 9, the recommendations stay the same through adulthood, 3 cups of dairy per day. When Andrea Wiley was growing up, drinking a couple cups of cow's milk every day was expected and encouraged. Her mom was a school nutritionist who drove around with a Got Milk bumper sticker on her car. But then Andrea started studying biological anthropology in college, and she learned that not everyone drinks cow's milk into adulthood. Not everyone can.
When I started to learn about population variation and the ability to digest milk, it kind of raised a lot of questions for me about what I had grown up assuming about milk.
Now she's made a career of researching the human consumption of milk. For more on this, I want to hand it off to Lee Bush and Maddie Chera from Indiana University's Food Institute. Hi.
Hi, Annie.
Hi, Annie. Great to be here.
Yeah.
I'm Lee.
I'm Maddie.
There's actually a lot of conversations happening about food and diet these days. We've seen it in both research and the popular media. We're starting to understand more and more about how the foods we eat interacts with not just our physical bodies. With Andrea's research, she's also interested in finding the connections with culture, history, and our food lives.
So it's pretty well established at this point that the mutation that underlies the ability to digest the lactose in milk could spread only in populations that have histories of dairying. We now have worked out the underlying genetics of that, what specific mutations are there. There are different ones in Europe than exist in sub-Saharan African pastoralist populations, but they all have the same effect of basically keeping this enzyme that's called lactase on throughout life in most, if not all, well, most mammals and most humans, that gene actually has a regulatory area next to it that turns it off. Early in childhood, for most mammals, it's sometime around the time of weaning, which makes good sense because mammals are never going to see milk again. So it's an unusual feature of some human populations that gene does not get turned off. It persists. This is what we call lactase persistence.
So we have a lot of lingo here, Annie, that we need to define. Lactase persistence means you have the genetic mutation that allows you to digest the lactose in milk throughout your life. The flip side of that is lactase impersistence, which should not be confused with lactose intolerance.
Okay, all right.
Right. So lactose intolerance is a biomedical diagnostic term for what happens if you drink milk and then develop uncomfortable gastrointestinal symptoms.
Okay, got it.
Okay, so that's the biology of it. Andrea also looks at the cultural side of things. In the case of milk, many, many generations ago, certain pockets of humans decided to domesticate other mammals and drink their milk.
How did that set up a new kind of evolutionary scenario that led to basically natural selection favoring the spread of lactase persistence in populations that did develop dairying? And so you have a cultural change that leads to a biological change. And what I am fascinated in as well is how we understand biology in a cultural context. So when you have a population where most people have the mutation that allows them to drink milk, how does that then get elaborated in cultural institutions that, for example, promote milk as an ideal food or, you know, this kind of perfect food for humans?
And this hit especially close to home when her first son was born.
For example, when I would take my son to the pediatrician and one of the questions they asked is, you know, what kind of milk is your child drinking? And I thought, well, that's an interesting way of asking that question. Not, why aren't you asking me, you know, what does your child drink or does your child drink milk? Instead, it was assumed your child drank milk and the question was simply what kind.
And the assumption is that not only do all kids drink dairy milk, but that milk is essential to helping them grow into healthy adults.
I think many of us heard that phrase growing up, that you have to drink your milk in order to grow. And so I was surprised when I started working on this about 10 years ago to find that there was actually very little written on this topic. It was a cultural assumption that didn't seem to have a strong scientific or body of evidence supporting it. I will say that there's absolutely no evidence at this point that calcium itself is what is making children grow. There are a number of calcium supplementation studies that don't show any impact on growth.
This idea that milk helps kids grow taller is part of what she's currently studying in India, where, like the U.S., dairy is an important part of the culture.
Milk has a complex cultural status there as well, and certainly in the Indian context, where you have a majority Hindu population, the cow is a sacred animal. At the same time, most of the milk in India actually comes from buffalo, who are not or do not have sacred status.
She's been following a group of children for 6 years to try to understand how milk relates to kids' growth. We'll have to talk to her again when that project is published.
So we asked her for a takeaway about milk's place in our culture. And she said, despite its importance to some of us, it is not necessarily essential to a nutritious diet.
Right. We have to look at the evidence and also consider the influences. She made a point of saying that the dairy industry has been very successful in overseeing child nutrition programs. Mm-hmm. But milk remains a fixture in our food culture, and Andrea's work explores why. Bottom line, milk is an especially interesting food, both biologically and culturally.
As an anthropologist, I think a close and holistic examination of particular foods actually tells us a great deal about ourselves. Milk just happens to be this phenomenal example, I think, because there's such a strong biological component to it that maps onto, you know, human biological variation, and there's an interesting evolutionary story around it.
Which brings to mind, Annie, that Andrea has a project in the works on another rather special food at the intersection of biology and culture. Gluten.
Oh, well, how timely is that?
I know.
Andrea Wiley has written two books about milk, Reimagining Milk, Cultural and Biological Perspectives, and Cultures of Milk, the Biology and Meaning of Dairy Products in the United States and India.
That was Annie Corrigan, Earth Eats founder and former host. Andrea Wiley spoke with Maddie Chera and Lee Bush with the Indiana University Food Institute. We'll have Andrea Wiley back on our show soon to talk about her research on gluten. With cooler weather, we look for something warm and comforting to draw everyone to the dinner table. Susan Mintert, host of the Indiana Home Cooks podcast, has a savory soup that fits the bill, her Italian sausage and lentil soup. Susan starts with diced onion, carrot, and celery, often known as a mirepoix, the base of many great soups and sauces.
And in addition to those vegetables from the refrigerator, I had some diced tomatoes, canned diced tomatoes, so I got one can of those. And then I also thought, well, let's think of something we can add to the soup to make it a little more filling. Sometimes we think of a pasta or a noodle or something like that. I had lentils in my cupboard, about a half a bag, so I thought I can use all or most of those in this soup. So I'm calling it a sausage and lentil soup. So we just started out browning the sausage, and my Italian sausage is in links, so I just split open the casings and got the meat out and then browned it right in my soup pot. And I browned all of that meat, it was about a pound, removed it from the pot, and then set it aside. Then to the fat that was left in the pot, I just put in the diced vegetables, the carrots, celery, and onion, gave them a quick stir around, and then I put the lid on to allow those vegetables to just sweat a little bit. And as they're sweating, their moisture is accumulating in the pot, and it's helping to loosen up all those bits of meat stuck to the bottom of the pot. And that'll release into our soup and give it a lot of great flavor. So you never want to let that go to waste. So after we got the vegetables softened up a little bit, I added the rest of the ingredients, the can of diced tomatoes and my lentils and some seasoning. And I'm seasoning this just with some dried sage. So I crush that up and put it right on top, a few grinds of pepper, and then I put in the broth that I had. I happen to have part of a container of beef broth in my refrigerator, and I knew I wanted to use that up as well. So I put all that in, added some more water just to bring the level up so that you've got maybe an inch above all of your other ingredients, and tasted it for seasoning. I added just a little bit of salt. So I'm going to just let that simmer now for about an hour to cook the lentils and just to bring everything together. And that's really all it takes for this soup. So it's just about an hour later. The soup is done. I just topped it with a sprinkling of some fresh parsley. But the soup itself is very hearty, and it's highly seasoned just from the Italian sausage and that dried sage that I put in. Those are really the only seasonings, and a little bit of salt and pepper. But it's got a very hearty flavor, savory flavor, you know, a really good kind of stick to your ribs on a cool evening kind of a meal.
Susan Mintert is a home cook in West Lafayette, Indiana. She's host of the Indiana Home Cooks podcast. The recipe for Susan's Italian sausage and lentil soup can be found at indianahomecooks.com and on our website, eartheats.org. Production support comes from Need More Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. Offering signature drinks, teas, and little eats. Located on Pete Ellis Drive, needmoreroasters.com. And The Clean Bedroom, offering organic mattresses, adjustable beds, and pillows. Helping mindful customers create a sustainable and organic clean bedroom, step by step. New York City, Boston, and now Indianapolis. More at thecleanbedroom.com. Thanks to the Earth Eats crew, including Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Alex Chambers, Taylor Killow, Daniel Orr, everyone at Farm Bloomington Restaurant, and Harvest Public Media. Special thanks this week to Andrea Wiley, Annie Corrigan, Lee Bush, Maddie Chera, and Susan Mintert. Earth Eats theme music is composed by Aaron Toby and performed by Aaron and Matt Toby. Our executive producer is John Bailey. I'm Kate Young, and I produce the show, and I thank you for listening to Earth Eats. Remember that we love hearing from you. You can leave us reviews on iTunes, join us on Twitter @EarthEats, or send us an email, eartheats@gmail.com.